using leverage, subtle, magnetic, and strategic. These women actively enjoy building connections that benefit not only their organizations and a wide range of people, but also, and very emphatically, themselves. Yet we also see talented, hard-working women who rebel at the very thought of engaging others to help them meet either specific or long-term career goals. They'll gladly spend time and energy getting to know people, offering them help, listening to their problems, giving advice, and drawing them close. But they shrink at the prospect of engaging them in a way that furthers their own ambitions. When we ask women who are uncomfortable with the very notion of leverage what holds them back, we usually hear some variation on the following. I don't want others to think I'm using them. I want people to know I value them for themselves, not for what they can do for me. I don't like self-serving people, and I don't want to be one. Basically, I'm not a hustler. Political games are really not my thing. These statements make clear the underlying belief that exercising leverage translates as not being a very nice person. This is problematic because leveraging relationships is key for achieving professional success. Most great careers are built not just on talent or hard work, but on the mutual exchange of benefits, something men are often more comfortable with than women. There's a kind of win-win horse trading that seems to come naturally to a lot of men. They enjoy it. They're comfortable saying, if you go to bat for me on this, I'll be there for you. Having a close relationship with someone is often less important to them than being able to count on that person's support when they need it. This is a standard way of operating in most organizations. So women who aren't comfortable in developing win-win partnerships can put themselves at a disadvantage. Julie Johnson, the executive coach mentioned in Chapter 2, concurs. She says, in my observation, when men build relationships at work, they're usually very focused. They pursue people they believe can help them accomplish their objectives. Women often have multiple reasons for developing relationships. They look up to a successful peer and want her as a friend. They need someone to talk with about their work. They feel sorry for a coworker and want to help him out. They just want people in general to like them. Or maybe they're sticking with a relationship they've outgrown in the name of loyalty. None of these motivations, except sometimes the last, is harmful in itself, Julie points out. And building close relationships can be personally rewarding and provide emotional sustenance and support, both of which are important, especially for women who feel isolated in their jobs. But if you steadfastly refuse to leverage the relationships you've built in pursuit of your goals, you will diminish your ability to reach your full potential. And that would be a shame. For not only will your reluctance deprive you of the help you need to act on your dreams and fulfill your talents, it will undermine your efforts to support colleagues, peers, and direct reports. By restricting your sphere of influence and taking yourself out of what you may dismiss as a distasteful political game, you will ultimately erode your capacity to make a difference in the world. The basics of leverage. Leverage is a key career skill, a strategic way of operating that can pay outsized rewards. Successful leaders know how to employ it. They may be subtle or direct, depending on their preferred style. But if you run across someone who has real significance as a leader, you can bet he or she uses leverage every chance they get. Even if you're uncomfortable or skeptical with the subject of leverage, you can benefit by understanding the basics of how it works. It differs from building relationships in four ways. 1. Leverage is always reciprocal, based on a quid pro quo. The underlying premise is, you help me and I'll help you. This reciprocity may be stated and explicitly promised, or it may be implied and tacitly understood. But leveraged relationships always operate to mutual advantage. When you ask for something, you offer something in return, and you and the other person both continue to seek to be of service to one another. Leverage can be the basis of a relationship or merely an aspect of a relationship that also has a personal dimension. The point is that both people involved understand that they are using one another to improve their access to resources, broaden their professional connections, and create mutually beneficial opportunities. The underlying belief is that a rising tide will lift all boats. 2. Leverage is used to achieve both tactical and strategic goals. You initiate leverage when you make a request. Usually the request is small and specific. I'm representing an artist whose prints are perfect for hotel lobbies. Do you know anyone in the hotel business who could introduce me to dealers who acquire work for their properties? Or, more simply, would you be willing to share your insights about what motivates this client? These are tactical favors in that they help you accomplish immediate objectives, things that would be helpful to you this week, this month, this year. Yet at its most effective, leverage also serves a larger strategic purpose of engaging those who might be helpful to you in the future. Your tactical request opens the door to a give and take that may not pay immediate dividends, but may help you realize a long-term goal down the road. The person to whom you make the request will also view the relationship as having potential value when he or she moves to a higher level. This kind of reciprocity works best when your goals harmonize with and complement those of the people you seek to engage. 3. Leverage is highly intentional. You establish a leveraged relationship with a specific purpose in mind, which means you use different criteria than when you establish a friendship. Does the person you seek to engage have relationships that could be useful to you, now or in the future? Does she seem poised to become more powerful over time? Is there something you're particularly well positioned to offer him now that might make him eager to be a resource for you in the future? Liking the other person is not the primary point, though it's never a good idea to seek a reciprocal relationship with someone you dislike. That road leads to mutual exploitation, which can look a lot like leverage but has the potential to create an unholy mess. More important than how you feel about the person is how well the two of you are positioned to be useful to one another over time. This is what distinguishes leverage from friendship, though the two may overlap and very often do. 4. Leverage brings distinctive rewards. In the previous chapter, we looked at the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic rewards in relation to mastery and recognition. These concepts also apply to leverage. In friendship and simple colleague relations, the rewards are intrinsic, which means highly personal and subjective. You like how someone makes you feel. You enjoy his sense of humor. You're inspired or comforted after you talk to her. In leveraged relationships, the rewards are extrinsic, which means they are measurable and concrete. You gain access to a new group of potential clients or investors. You have an opportunity to enhance your reputation and visibility or learn a new skill. In establishing leverage, your purpose is always front and center. This doesn't mean you don't respect or enjoy spending time with the other person, but the intrinsic rewards are a bonus instead of the point. In a good cause, the transactional, tactical, strategic, and intentional aspects of leverage can be a stumbling block for women. The high value women place on relationships often makes them more eager to seek out personal friendships that offer intrinsic rewards than to cultivate connections and collect chits for future use. Women who balk at using leverage often view disinterested relationships as more pure, proof that you're a trustworthy and honorable person. Horse trading may imply you have an agenda and are out for yourself. There are two problems with this kind of thinking. The first is that it assumes a degree of powerlessness on your part. This is because underlying the you help me and I'll help you ethos is an unstated promise that you have the potential to be useful to the person you're engaging. You aren't just some poor soul asking for help. You're a potential resource that the other person would be fortunate to have in the years ahead. In other words, engaging leverage is a subtle way of suggesting that you're going places, that you're a player whose help can be of value down the road. Refusing to engage in this way on the grounds that you don't want to use the other person suggests that you don't see yourself as having this kind of power, and that you can't imagine the other person would perceive an advantage in having a relationship with you. The second problem with seeing leverage as a morally suspect behavior is that it reveals that familiar either-or mindset we've been harping on in this book. Either you're a wonderful person with pure intentions who gives no thought to your own advancement, or you're a conniver who uses others to achieve your own ends. Either you're motivated by the desire for disinterested friendship, or you're only out for yourself. This kind of framing allows for no middle ground, no way of being a good and helpful person who is also capable of pursuing her own self-interest. The either-or mindset shows itself most clearly when a woman who disdains using leverage in her career is perfectly comfortable doing so in the service of a good cause. This is quite common. Take Amanda, a product coordinator for a manufacturer of medical devices. Amanda's company has a global reputation and takes a lot of pride in its products. Recently, she was approached by one of her company's top salesmen about the hospital where she previously worked as an administrator. Amanda has kept her ties with a lot of her old colleagues, not because they're potential clients, her job is more internally facing, but because she loved the camaraderie of her old team. She says, "Kevin asked me to introduce him to a few of the senior people I knew so he could connect with them about some of our products. I was uncomfortable with this for several reasons. I consider these people personal friends and don't want them to feel hustled. He's a real hotshot in sales and known to be pretty aggressive. Also, Kevin never showed a shred of interest in me until he found out I'd worked at that hospital. He doesn't seem to care about me as a person, so why should I set him up?" Amanda didn't want to come right out and say no, so she tried to avoid Kevin. "I was hoping he'd get the message I wasn't interested, but he continued to call and press me. Really, the way he kept at it was pretty shameless." Perhaps so, but that's not a great reason for Amanda to spurn the opportunity to do a simple favor for one of her company's stars, someone who is on a strong trajectory pointed up. If she wanted to protect her friends at the hospital, she could have asked them if they minded her providing the introduction. Or she could have told them to use their own judgment about whether to respond when Kevin called. And since she knows her company's products are superior, the connection could have been to her old friend's advantage. The only thing Amanda was really protecting was her own belief that asserting leverage on behalf of self-interest was an unsavory and self-interested practice. Yet even as she was putting her nose in the air about Kevin, Amanda was forging connections and twisting arms on behalf of a domestic violence shelter that had opened in her community, calling neighbors to buy tickets to the fundraiser and enlisting colleagues as volunteers. In taking on the cause of the women who sought refuge, Amanda was not in the least concerned that pressuring people she was friendly with was taking advantage of them or being a hustler. Because she saw the goal as worthy, she was perfectly comfortable employing the same shameless tactics as Kevin had. It wasn't his tactics she objected to, but employing those tactics in the pursuit of his own self-interest. Acting on your strength. Our experience has convinced us that leverage is a key career skill that many women could make better use of as they seek to rise. But we also recognize that the inhibitions many feel about using it are rooted in one of women's most profound and characteristic strengths. Decades of research confirm that women's preference for building strong personal relationships instead of transactional alliances serves them as a great source of emotional fortitude, long-term resilience, and everyday joy. Women's close friendships are a boon to them and the envy of many men who wish they could talk more intimately with friends when they're in trouble, depressed, or feel alone. So please don't get the idea we're urging you to undervalue your gift for intimacy or rein in your warmth and concern for others in favor of a more leveraged approach. Instead, you might think about how to bring your skills for forging deep connections into play as you seek to become more intentional in building relationships that may be advantageous to you in the future. This is certainly the approach taken by women who are superb at leverage, which is why their efforts can be so compelling and magnetic. You might also examine the degree to which your dismissal of any quid pro quo element in relationships is based on a moralistic judgment. It helps to remember that leverage is a two-way street, and that even as you benefit, you are also benefiting someone else. Successful leverage is the very definition of a win-win. It's good for you and it's good for the other person. And the more genuinely others see that you're invested in the mutuality of the relationship, the more value you will create for them and for the world.
Chapter 9. Habit 5. Failing to enlist allies from day one. You're just starting a new job. It could be with a new company or in a new division of the company you've joined 10 years ago. Like Anna, the Silicon Valley engineer in Chapter 7, you may be feeling a bit out of your depth. You're a novice when it comes to certain skills. You don't know how to get your hands on resources you need, and you aren't sure whom to ask. Your boss seems friendly and well-informed, but she's in the middle of a hiring spree and you don't want to pester her with questions. But you do need to get up to speed quickly, so you decide to focus on learning as much as you can by studying the masses of material HR has provided and immersing yourself in the details of your job. When you've got a better handle on what you're doing, you'll put your head up and start building connections. If this is your plan, please do not proceed. You're about to make a very common mistake. It's a mistake we have both watched many talented women make, often as a consequence of overvaluing expertise. Habit 3. Or being reluctant to leverage relationships. Habit 4. Sometimes it's a way of avoiding the well-known female imposter syndrome, the fear of being unmasked as unworthy or not up to the job. Sometimes you're afraid you'll be seen as a burden. Whatever the cause, it's rarely an effective approach. Nevertheless, it persists. Women who assume new positions resolve to keep their heads down until they've mastered the details and are confident they can perform to a certain standard. They want to feel fully prepared before they start reaching out. By contrast, men in new positions often start with a question, "Who should I connect with to make this job a success?" They view the path to success not as a matter of what or how, but who. They see connections as the most important part of their job, and they want to start building them on day one. The result of this who-centric approach? More support, better positioning, greater visibility, less isolation. And not incidentally, a lot less work. Of course, we also see women who immediately start building connections. Successful, experienced women who know that expertise is only one source of power and is rarely the most important one. Women who recognize that getting stuck in the weeds is particularly ill-advised at the start of a job or project when you're in most need of support. But it takes other women a while to figure this out, especially in companies or sectors where they've long been underrepresented. If that's your situation, you may feel awkward reaching out or skeptical that your mostly male coworkers want to get to know you. Or you may be convinced that you need to earn their respect before you even approach them. Which path you choose will usually depend on what you believe will make you most credible at work. Is it what you do or who you're allied with? Of course, it's always going to be both. If you have great connections but don't deliver, you will never inspire trust. But connections built in tandem with expertise from the get-go will make for a smoother path. To be fully credible, you're always going to need allies. Allies are peers, colleagues, higher-ups, sponsors, direct reports, and internal and external fans who support your efforts to get where you want to go. Allies know what you're trying to achieve, believe it has value, and sense they have a stake in it, and do what they can do to move you along. They help you find the resources you need to do a tough job, and they get the word out about your contributions. You do the same for them because allies help each other, and mutuality lies at the root of alliance. Allies are also broadly based. People at junior levels can be valuable allies, as can those who hold frontline support or resource positions. The more inclusive your ally web, the more robust your support. Allies are the heart and soul of a successful career. Allies don't have to be friends. People with expansive and resilient webs have dozens of acquaintanceships that may last for decades without becoming personally close. Sociologists call these relationships weak ties and note that people are far more likely to find jobs and be rewarded for their efforts as a result of weak ties than the kind of strong ties that characterize close friendships. Researchers find that people with a lot of loose ties or strong ally networks share two practices in common. They reach out to others first instead of waiting for others to come to them, and they go out of their way to connect people with one another, even people they don't particularly know. Contrast this with Amanda in the previous chapter. In refusing to connect Kevin with her friends at the hospital, she cited in part that he'd never seemed to care about her as a person. If she'd understood the power of weak ties, she wouldn't have considered this a problem. She would have known it was in her interest to enlist Kevin as an ally, regardless of his potential or not, to be a friend, and willingly connected him with her old colleagues. She would have seen the value of drawing him into her network of connections. Allies, mentors, and sponsors. In the 1990s and early 2000s, women were exhorted to find mentors, experienced higher-ups who could offer guidance and advice. The idea became institutionalized in many organizations, with HR setting up mentoring circles or even hiring professional mentors to work with groups of women. But in 2011, the research organization Catalyst published a study that found, while mentorship could be helpful, sponsorship was the key success factor in women's careers. The idea took off. Mentors and sponsors are different in that mentors offer advice and serve as a sounding board, while sponsors are less about talk than action. A sponsor, usually a senior leader in your organization, serves as your advocate, puts your name forward for assignments, introduces you to important colleagues, and helps remove structural roadblocks that could keep you stuck. Obviously, sponsors can be of enormous value, but there's just one problem. They're notoriously difficult to find and engage. That's because there's a huge mismatch between the number of women seeking sponsors and the number of women or men available for sponsorship. Organizational pyramids being what they are, there are just not that many people at the top. As a woman on the executive committee of a large insurance firm remarked to Sally, "I can hardly open the door to my office without someone ambushing me about being their sponsor. There's so much emphasis on sponsorship for women, but a limited number of us to go around. Plus, formal sponsorship initiatives seem to have limited success. These kinds of relationships work best when there's an element of personal chemistry, so they're most effective if they're allowed to evolve." She added, "It's not healthy that so many women have come to believe sponsorship is the only way to move forward, a kind of magic wand that will transform their whole career. And women who haven't been able to find sponsors feel as if they've been found personally unworthy. They start blaming themselves instead of realizing it's a structural problem. Yet most senior women manage to get to where they are without a sponsor to help them. As the insurance executive points out, speaking for myself, it would have been wonderful to have someone powerful in the company in my corner. But 25 years ago, Nobody ever heard of a woman having that kind of support, at least not in this company. There were only senior male executives and the fair-haired boys they chose to promote, otherwise known as the Old Boys Network. Sponsors are a valuable kind of ally, but they're only one kind. So if you're struggling to find one, your best response might be to pour that energy into building a broad ally network instead. This will not only strengthen you, it will increase the likelihood that you'll find a sponsor by giving you more visibility and assuring your contributions get more widely known. Sheryl Sandberg, who has no doubt been inundated with sponsor requests for several decades during her rise at Google and then Facebook, writes in her book Lean In that potential sponsors are most likely to be attracted to people who already have a lot of support. In her view, sponsors are motivated to expend effort on behalf of those who they see already on a path to success, rather than those hoping for rescue or waiting for someone to notice them. And one of the ways you signal you're on that path is by actively building up your web of connections. In its original report, Catalyst also noted that sponsorship is most effective when it's been earned. As the authors observed, to attract sponsors, employees need to make their skills, strengths, and work known to colleagues as well as to senior leaders. They must build reputations as flexible, collegial professionals who are constantly committed to their own career development. How do you do this? By actively engaging allies, preferably from the day you start a new job. The Ambassador. Diana, a trademark litigator for a mineral conglomerate headquartered in Melbourne, Australia, has always been diligent about building connections. As a result, she attracted an excellent sponsor who was instrumental in landing Diana a stretch assignment in Singapore, where she was hired to lead the legal team in the company's large and profitable shipping division. Diana says, "I arrived knowing nothing about maritime law, which is extremely complex and could not be more different from what I'd been doing. Needless to say, I felt a bit overwhelmed. I told my boss, I intend to spend every waking hour getting up to speed on our practice. But that's not at all what he wanted to hear." Her boss told Diana he had not hired her because he needed another excellent maritime lawyer. He said the guys he had were extremely knowledgeable, but they had a long history of squabbling among themselves, withholding information from one another, and generally alienating our clients. I'd led a couple of successful teams in my former job, and he wanted me to do the same here. His exact words were, "You wouldn't be here if you weren't a good lawyer, but you're not here to be a good lawyer. You're here to be a leader. That's your job." Diana knew that she had to start forging relationships, but quickly realized that the worst place to start doing so was with her team. She says, "From the first meeting, the guys made clear they saw me as an unqualified outsider who'd been parachuted in by headquarters to take a job one of them deserved. The fact that I was a woman certainly didn't help. It was an incredibly macho culture. They had exactly zero interest in seeing me succeed, and you could cut the resentment with a knife. All I could do was be pleasant and not let them push me around. Trying to get buddy-buddy with them would have been a disaster." Instead, Diana began reaching out to people in operations who could help her access information and get resources flowing, and to customers and suppliers that her team had long ignored. She says, "At first I felt self-conscious because I was so behind the curve in terms of maritime practice, but I decided honesty was the best policy. I prepared for every encounter by making lists of questions. Being a lawyer by training, I was used to providing answers, so this was new behavior for me. But it taught me to take risks and be more open, and of course, I learned a lot." Once she had the lay of the land, Diana began joining regional trade groups, immersing herself in Singapore's rich maritime culture. After a few events, she realized that a number of connections from her previous job could be helpful to the people she was meeting, especially clients looking to expand their trading portfolios. She says, "I was surprised to find the network I built in Australia gave me currency I could use in the shipping world. Also, internal people began seeing me as a way to build up their own connections at headquarters. Without intending it, I became a kind of ambassador for our company in Singapore. This gave me a lot of visibility and strength." As Diana's web expanded, she began sharing resources and connections with members of her team. We'd be in a meeting and someone would bring up a problem. Instead of trying to provide an answer, I'd say, "I think Joe in operations could help you with that. I'll give him a call after this meeting." Or, "I happen to know a customer in Mumbai who would love your suggestion." Sharing contacts like this was really useful because, like most dysfunctional teams, the people I worked with were very inward-looking. Once they saw I could help them, they loosened up. I knew I'd made it when two of the guys who'd most resented me began soliciting my advice on a project. Now a corporate officer in Melbourne, Diana looks on her years in Singapore as the turning point in her career. Instead of seeing myself as a smart lawyer who scored points based on my knowledge of the law, I began to see myself as a leader who brought out the best in people and could help them connect across continents. I'd never be where I am now if I hadn't been forced to recognize that alliances are more important than what you know. Allies are your brand. Ever since Tom Peters' iconic Fast Company cover story, "The Brand Called You," was published in 1997, people have understood the importance of building a distinctive personal brand. When you think about your brand, you may think in terms of your skills, your reputation, and how you present yourself. These elements all comprise your brand. But as Diana learned when she stepped into her ambassador role in Singapore, your alliances are part of your brand as well. Effective personal marketers understand this. They know that alliances and connections establish them as potential leaders. This is why they can mention the names of colleagues without any discomfort and feel happy that their colleagues are doing the same. Name-dropping gets a bad rap, but it's only a problem if you're tenuously, or not at all, connected to the people you claim to know. If these people are in your orbit, sharing that information is not only a great way to enhance your brand, but a powerful means of building credibility. You are known by the company you keep. You're also talking about them in a way that helps them. Alliances have always been a big part of my brand as an executive coach, author, and thought leader, because having powerful people vouch for you is the best way to establish yourself in a competitive marketplace. As a coach, I make no bones about the simplicity of my technique, which is based on a very few straightforward steps: asking for feedback, thanking, following up, advertising, and feed forward, as you will hear in Chapter 19. Given this simplicity, how have I built a client base that includes many of the most high-profile CEOs in the world? By positively using the power of my connections in order to build my credibility as a coach and to help my clients help each other. These connections include my clients. While many coaches keep their client lists private, I only work with clients who are willing to openly discuss the fact that they have a coach. I always note that I've learned more from my clients than they've learned from me. I'm very proud of my clients, and they're more than happy to help me. For example, my book Triggers was endorsed by 27 major CEOs. This is a great source of pride for me. Why? Because 30 years ago, almost no CEO would admit to having a coach. They would have found it to be a sign of weakness. Today, smart CEOs are happy to have a coach and willing to talk about it. I regularly have my clients meet for dinner and discuss how they can help each other. I'm very comfortable with the fact that my clients often learn more from each other than they learn from me. This type of win-win situation is good for all of the participants. This strategy has multiple benefits. It establishes my clients as part of an elite group of learners. It gives them other people at the top to talk to, a scarce resource at the highest levels. It creates potential business relationships. It enhances everyone's public profile. And it builds my reputation as the coach with the A-plus list of clients. You can use a version of this approach starting where you are, using what you have, and whoever you know. When you enlist allies on a project, be sure to talk about them in a positive way. Praise what they've been doing and connect them with others. You don't need to be the world's biggest extrovert to do this. You don't need to make friends or form close ties. You just need to engage as many people as possible in your efforts to have an impact. And you want to do it in a public way so that you and they can benefit from the association. The ideal time to do this is when you're starting a new job. It will build your support and establish your credibility faster than anything else you might try. But it's also a useful technique if you've been in your job for a while. Ask yourself, what do you want your next step to be? What project would you like to be involved in? Then identify 5 people who could be helpful and start telling them what you want to do. You might say, Carol, I'd like to expand my client base in the western suburbs. Do you know anyone I might contact? I'll let them know how well your team is doing. Or, Ben, I heard you signed up that great comedy act that performed at our last retreat. Could you let me know how you found them? I'm planning an event for my professional network. Maybe you'd like to come. These are tiny asks and offers, but that's not the point. The idea is to start pulling people into your network by asking and returning small favors. A willingness to trade favors and form alliances is the lifeblood of a successful career. So you'll want to get comfortable reaching out at the first opportunity.
Chapter 10. Habit 6. Putting your job before your career. We frequently work with smart, talented, hardworking women who quickly ascend to a certain level and then remain there for an unusually long time. These women often rationalize their situation, citing things they like about their jobs, such as the comfort of long-term relationships and being able to use skills they've had a chance to hone. But deep down, many of them feel frustrated. They watch colleagues who entered the company in the same year they did sail past them. They see someone they hired snag a high-profile job they'd hoped for. They watch their salary increase by tiny increments despite outstanding performance because their company's policies peg salary to position. If you find yourself stuck like this, you may have devoted so much time and energy to doing your job superbly that you've neglected to take the steps needed to propel you to the next level. Maybe you haven't built the visibility and connections you need to create a demand for your skills. Maybe you've sent so many signals that you enjoy being where you are that people no longer think of your name when a higher level position opens up. If this describes you, you're probably focusing on your job at the expense of your career. You're looking at what's on your plate now instead of seeing the big picture. You're sacrificing your long-term prospects on the altar of today. Of course, you may love your job and feel it's a great fit, so your reluctance is understandable. But remaining stuck is never a good idea. Staying in the same job too long undermines your long-term satisfaction and feelings of self-worth. It diminishes your ability to have an impact as well as your earning potential. It sidelines you and sends a message that you don't believe you deserve better. Why does this happen so often with women? Is there an underlying reason? Of course, your organization may be more challenging for you than for men who fit the boss's image of a real up-and-comer. But often there's something else at play. Perhaps you feel undecided about what you really want to do and let your uncertainty paralyze your ability to act. Or maybe you're temperamentally averse to risk. But in our experience, the most common reason women put their job before their career is rooted in one of their greatest virtues, loyalty. Research shows that loyalty is a primary reason women tend to stay in their jobs longer than men. It's a virtue that can easily become a trap. The desire to be loyal can lead you to neglect your future, sacrifice your ambitions, and sell your talent and potential short. Others may benefit, but you do not. Personal loyalty. I met Serena at a point where Serena's dissatisfaction had finally surfaced and inspired her to try a new approach. She had spent 11 years as a senior production assistant for a network news show based in L.A., which qualifies as an unusually long time to stay in such a job in her business. The producer Serena worked for had won a notable number of Emmys, and she had always felt proud to work for him. She loved the fact that he constantly praised her contributions and talked about how lucky he was to have someone with her talent and experience working for him. He had even called her out for special thanks when he won his most recent Emmy, which thrilled her parents, immigrants from Egypt who enjoy watching American awards shows and were ecstatic to hear their daughter's name mentioned on network TV. Serena liked the day-to-day rhythm of her job, valued her leadership role on the team, and felt she benefited from her boss's prestige. But remaining a senior PA for so long had provided its share of painful moments. She says, "A male assistant who joined when I did took off like a rocket, becoming a producer after just 5 years. He was no better at his job than I was, but he was constantly on the lookout for opportunities. I waited for opportunities, figuring my boss and senior management would know when I was ready to move up." Attending a leadership retreat for media professionals from diverse backgrounds provided Serena with her wake-up call. The program focused on career development. Participating in the workshops and getting individual coaching helped her see that she needed to start thinking long-term, or she could end up being a PA for the rest of her life. The experience also forced Serena to confront the role she'd played in keeping herself where she was. Like many women, she'd always taken the just work hard approach, attending to what needed to be done that day, that week, or that month. She says, "I knew I wanted to produce, but I always figured that when the time was right, it would happen. That retreat made clear that my approach wasn't working. I needed a different plan." As she considered how to take action, Serena realized her first task had to be letting people at the network know she was ready for a challenge. But the thought of doing so stirred up strong feelings that gave her a clue to the fears that had held her back. "Just the idea of telling my boss I wanted his support in becoming a producer basically filled me with dread. I was afraid he'd see me as disloyal for leaving him in the lurch. I was afraid he'd think I'd just been using my position with him as a stepping stone, as if standing on the same stone for 11 years wasn't enough." The more she thought about it, the more Serena realized that her sense of loyalty was keeping her stuck. Because she felt grateful to her boss, she had never pushed for another position. And while he had never exploited her, Serena's passivity had benefited him at every turn. Serena also realized that, although her boss had always been lavish in praising her, he mostly did so to staff and other producers. He'd never raved about her work to the senior network people in New York, yet they were the ones who needed to know what she was capable of if she had any expectation of moving on. "Why wouldn't he have talked to them about me?" she wondered. "Partly because I'd never asked him to. But maybe the other reason was that I'd made myself indispensable to him over the years. So why would he have taken the initiative to help me move on? Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying my still being a PA was his fault. I did it to myself. But I needed to get over my attachment to being seen as totally loyal if I wanted to become a producer." Some of Serena's resistance had to do with family. She knew her parents would never understand her wanting to move higher, not only because they idolized her boss, but because they came from a culture in which anyone who managed to land a decent job hung on to it forever. "In Egypt," she says, "you were lucky to have any job, so you proved yourself worthy by being fanatically loyal. If you weren't, you were seen as arrogant and irresponsible to your family." Once Serena understood that loyalty had been the chief factor in keeping her trapped, she was able to approach her boss about her desire to move ahead. He was immediately cooperative, and within months she was producing a series of documentaries in New York. "I was so worried he'd think I was disloyal," she reflects, "but most jobs are stepping stones on the way to something else. And I've come to realize there's no shame in using where you are to position yourself for what you want next. Of course he understood that. How could he not? That's what he did, or he wouldn't have gotten to where he was. Team loyalty. Serena was loyal to her boss, but we often come across women who sacrifice their ambitions because of loyalty to their team or unit. Carlos Moren, an executive coach who works extensively in Latin America as well as the United States, finds overcommitment to the team to be a primary reason women fail to invest in their own careers. Carlos says, "Many women I work with get very involved with nurturing their team and spend huge amounts of time with their people. This is great for their people, and it can provide intrinsic rewards for the women, but it doesn't necessarily serve them to be so internally focused." That's because, in Carlos's view, their devotion to their teams can cause highly accomplished women to neglect building the networks with senior leaders and external partners they need to advance. As Carlos says, so while their male colleagues are building relationships that will help them in the future, the women are spending all their working hours managing their teams. They appear to enjoy it, and it certainly pays off in terms of their team's performance, but it does not get the women where they want to go. Not only are these women failing to build relationships that could position them for the future, they're actively honing and advertising a skill that identifies them as suited for a less than senior level. As Carlos points out, managing a team superbly ultimately proves you have great skills as a manager. But building strong outside networks is a promotional skill aimed at getting recognition for the larger organization. So while women are honing their management skills and sending the message that they're wonderful managers, their male colleagues are busy building promotional skills and sending the message that they're terrific promoters. This matters because top leadership roles tend to be more about potential for the next level of responsibility than management of the current level of responsibility, a reality often misunderstood at managerial levels. As Carlos observes, senior executives succeed by extending external relationships in a way that serves the larger organization. They also deal with the board on big-picture strategic issues. They do not succeed by only being great managers of internal people. The upshot is that if, out of loyalty to your team, you allow your energy to be consumed by conscientiously tending to its needs, you will primarily prove that you are superbly suited for remaining in an internally facing position. The management skills that have gotten you here will end up keeping you here, instead of helping you rise to a place where you could have maximum impact. Healthy self-interest. In addition to realizing that her loyalty to her boss was keeping her trapped, Serena became aware of another vulnerability. She says, "I had this incredible fear of appearing or of being self-serving. I kept remembering the guy who made Producer after just 5 years. He talked about nothing except producing. He was a production assistant, but he introduced himself as a producer. At the time, I thought it was pompous and showed he was out for himself. But now I think, what's so terrible about looking out for your own interests?" Women are frequently uncomfortable admitting self-interest, not only to others but to themselves. This can keep you focused on your job instead of your career. By contrast, thinking in terms of career development suggests that you view every job or project as a way of positioning yourself for what might come next. This doesn't mean you only think about the future instead of appreciating where you are now. But it does mean you assess the value of every job, not just in terms of how much you enjoy it or how valued you are, but also in terms of how it could serve your long-term self-interest. And there's nothing wrong with this. In fact, it's just being smart. After all, what defines self-interest in the workplace? Ultimately, it's being able to create the conditions for building a career that gives full scope to your talents while providing you with the means to build a life that feels satisfying and worthwhile. You exercise this self-interest by pursuing jobs that maximize your potential to achieve these goals, not just now, but over the span of your working life. Of course, your definition of self-interest may not be the same as someone else's. Maybe you value time more than money. Maybe time with your family is paramount. Maybe you want a career that offers variety or the chance to travel or brings you into contact with people you admire, or one that provides financial independence. Whatever it is, knowing what inspires you and working intentionally to create it requires that you acknowledge and then act upon your self-interest. Self-interest doesn't seem to be a problem for many of the men we work with. Men usually like the idea of winning, so they're comfortable putting their interests and those of their family first. Some women do this, but others seem to think that pursuing their self-interest will make them a bad person. Heidi is an analyst for a global financial corporation. She's seen as brilliant, but her career had stalled when Marshall was brought in as her coach. In their first meeting, he asked what she thought might be her problem. "The first thing you need to know," said Heidi, "is that I'm not like a lot of the guys here. They never think about the bank. They think about themselves, what they can get out of working here. They're upfront about it, so they spend more time angling for promotions than doing their jobs. That's not my way. Delivering the best work I can is more important to me than schmoozing or playing politics. I think more about this institution than I do about my own career." She paused for a moment, then added thoughtfully, "Maybe that's my problem?" Marshall had to agree. He said, "Here's how I see it. This bank is doing well because it's very good at investing people's money. The bank is highly ethical, which is great, but it's not saving the world. I think that you should do your best to help the bank. You should also do your best to have a great career and a great life. As long as you're not doing anything immoral, unethical, or illegal, you don't need to sacrifice your future for the bank. And who are you to judge other people here and decide they are lesser human beings because they, along with helping the bank, are interested in helping themselves and their families?" Marshall's words startled Heidi. But over the next few months, she began to view her desire to demonstrate loyalty to her institution and disdain for her own self-interest in a different light. Maybe her self-righteous insistence that she didn't want to play the game was in fact a clever way of keeping herself stuck. She began asking herself what she was really trying to achieve. Why was she at the bank? What kept her in her job? And where did she ultimately want it to lead her? If her values were so at odds with the demands of her profession, would she be better off at a nonprofit? Or was she simply trying to deny the very real satisfaction she took in her work as an analyst? Pondering these questions forced Heidi to realize that her judgments about the people she worked with only served to alienate her and make her feel misunderstood. To be honest, she enjoyed using her extraordinary analytic skills and insights. She loved the intellectual challenge, and she felt a guilty pleasure when she bested her colleagues. Why guilty? Probably because her mother had always admonished her that being competitive was unbecoming in a girl. She didn't agree with her mother then or now, but she was behaving as if she did. Once she figured this out, Heidi was able to admit that she liked being really good at her work and that bailing on her job to pursue something different was a self-sabotaging idea. She simply needed to let go of the sense of guilt instilled in her from childhood that held her back from realizing her full potential. She needed, in Sheryl Sandberg's phrase, to lean in. So if you're stuck in the loyalty trap or have a problem admitting self-interest, or if you make a big point of disdaining the politics you see other people play, you can benefit by considering how well these attitudes really serve you, how suited they are for getting you where you want to go. Women who use their jobs as a way to avoid thinking about their careers often have a problem admitting to ambition. But the world needs ambitious women. Why not you?
Chapter 11. Habit 7. The Perfection Trap. Striving to be perfect may have helped you get where you are, but it will get in your way as you aspire to higher levels. There are many reasons this is so. Striving to be perfect creates stress for you and those around you, because it's based on expectations that human beings may occasionally live up to, but which cannot be sustained over time. Striving to be perfect keeps you riveted on details, distracting you from the big picture orientation that's expected when you reach a senior position. Striving to be perfect creates a negative mindset in which you're bothered by every little thing that goes wrong, since even a small mistake can ruin the whole, and negativity is never valued in a leader. Striving to be perfect sets you up for disappointment for the simple reason it's unrealistic. You and the people who work with you and for you will never be perfect, at least as long as you live on planet Earth. In our experience, women are especially vulnerable to the perfection trap, the belief that they will succeed if they do their job perfectly and never mess anything up. While women in general tend to be seen as better leaders than men, they're often undermined by their tendency to give themselves a hard time, a habit rooted in the desire to be perfect. The result is that even high-achieving women tend to take failures deeply to heart, get tangled up in self-blame, and stew over mistakes instead of moving on. Other coaches and practitioners we work with share this assessment. Julie Johnson, the executive coach quoted in Chapter 8, finds that the desire to be perfect is one of the two most serious challenges facing the women she works with. You'll hear about the other one in the next chapter. This has not changed during her 30 years in the field, yet she rarely sees perfectionism among her male clients. Why women? Why are women often vulnerable to this desire to be perfect, or the belief that if they're not perfect, they're somehow unworthy? Experience and research suggests two reasons: gender expectations that start in childhood, and how those expectations get reinforced in the workplace. Girls tend to be rewarded for being obedient daughters and excellent students, while boys are given more latitude. People will often speak fondly about a naughty little boy. He's considered charming, amusing, and adorable. That's especially true if he's good at sports, where cutting corners and showboating is routinely rewarded, along with bending the rules in order to score points. By contrast, girls who fail to conform to expected standards don't get much of a break. Schools are far more likely to penalize girls for acting out and for aggressive behaviors such as fighting. With boys, these behaviors are often dismissed as a testosterone spurt, but they're viewed as disgraceful in girls. These attitudes often prevail even in families and schools committed to gender equality. Such expectations can prompt girls to seek approval by striving to get everything right, avoiding mistakes, and dotting every I. In other words, trying to be perfect. Girls consistently average higher grades than boys, in part because they develop earlier, but also in part because doing so is the surest way to earn approval. It's not that boys don't get rewarded for good grades, but the boys who receive the most praise are usually the sports stars. As athletes, they're expected to be assertive, show confidence, stand out from the pack, and be bold. After all, a Hail Mary pass is admired even when it fails to hit its intended receiver. What's the greatest praise an athlete can receive? That he dominated. Valedictorians are never described in those terms. Executive coach Carlos Marin, quoted in the previous chapter, observes a similar pattern in organizations. Coaching data and the psychometric surveys we deliver when doing assessments suggest that men at the executive level are most likely to be rewarded for daring and risk-taking, he says. Women at similar levels are most likely to be rewarded for precision and correctness. The upshot is that many of the senior women Carlos and his team work with internalize the expectation that they should be conscientious and precise. He notes that this can result in an excessive fear of making mistakes that shows up in all sorts of ways. For example, even in high-stakes executive team meetings, men tend to be comfortable making statements they haven't necessarily thought through, or even stupid statements. But if a woman says something,